Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with John K. Wilson, author of the book Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. We'll also include a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission was once again in the hot seat up on Capitol Hill this week. The House held a hearing to address concerns about the results of the recent auction of public airwaves. One big problem is that giant telecom companies Verizon and AT&T won most of the prized 700 megahertz spectrum, which will be used for wireless services. Here's Congressman Ed Markey.
There is no new national competitor to provoke new broadband competition, innovation, and consumer choice coming out of the auction.
Markey said that a previous FCC decision to do away with caps on how much spectrum a company could bid for has proven to be a mistake.
Spectrum caps had ensured that incumbents couldn't gobble up all of the available spectrum and effectively box out would-be competitors from reaching the market.
Some Republican members of the committee were upset that the auction, which brought an unprecedented $19 billion into the Treasury, didn't make as much money as it could have. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin defended the requirements as a way to foster new innovation.
I think that we end up having to put auction rules in place that balance a variety of public interest factors and that raising money alone is not our sole goal.
Harold Feld, Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project, who also testified at the hearing, agreed.
The tragedy of our spectrum policy is that it has been reduced to four words. Show us the money.
Feld says that's not the way it's supposed to be.
The public interest goals that were laid out by Congress in 1993 when it first adopted the spectrum auction statute tell us that we deserve a world in which everyone has access to wireless opportunities, to the economic advantages that wireless technologies can bring, and in particular, women and minority-owned businesses and rural businesses, which for historic reasons have been denied access to capital or licenses, deserve a fair shake in these auctions.
Markey agreed.
We all have to be concerned by this. We all have to ensure that we include more minorities and women in the future of telecommunications for the 21st century. We gave away most of the licenses to white men who are already well-connected in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and to dig out of that hole is something that we all have to focus on.
And now, a guest commentary by Free Press Communications Director Craig Aaron.
The Consumerist blog recently set up a contest to determine America's worst company. The tournament's still going on, but I'm not afraid to predict the winner. It's going to be Comcast in a rout. How do I know? Well, first of all, because Comcast is the worst company in America. And I know what you're thinking. What about Walmart, Exxon, Halliburton? And I'll admit that I can't yet tie Comcast to child labor, environmental destruction, or even Dick Cheney. But clearly you've never sat around for 7 hours on a Saturday waiting for a new DVR. And I'm not alone in my seething rage for the nation's largest cable company. The internet is filled with sites like ComcastMustDie.com and ComcastSucks.org dedicated to the company. And then there's Mona Shaw. This once mild-mannered retired nurse from Northern Virginia, a square-dancing Unitarian, no less, got so fed up with Comcast's lousy customer service that she went down to the local office armed with a claw hammer. Here's how the Washington Post described it. Shaw storms into the company's office. Bam! She whacks the keyboard of the customer service rep. Bam! Down goes the monitor. Bam! She totals the telephone. People scatter, scream, cops show up. And what does she do? Pow! A parting shot to the phone. Now, awful customer service is one thing. But what's truly frightening are Comcast's plans for the future of the internet. Comcast is one of the leading opponents of net neutrality, the fundamental principle that prevents service providers from discriminating against websites. Comcast has long claimed that net neutrality is just a solution in search of a problem. Well, here's the problem. Last fall, the Associated Press caught Comcast secretly blocking popular and legal peer-to-peer file sharing. In response, Comcast denied it. Then they claimed it was just, quote, reasonable network management. The FCC held a hearing at Harvard in February to investigate. But Comcast was so afraid of public scrutiny that it hired seat fillers to crowd out the public and applaud on cue. But the ploy backfired in a big way. Net neutrality might be complicated, but everybody knows a dirty trick when they see it. If the FCC and Congress don't act quickly to stop Comcast and restore net neutrality, we may have to take matters into our own hands. Two words. Hammer time. Go with the flow. It is said if you can't rule the list, then you probably are dead.
So wave your hands in the air. Bust a few moves. Run your fingers through your hair. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net. You can't touch this. Look, man, you can't touch this.
You better get a hype, boy, because you know you can't touch this. And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Fidel Castro called biofuels genocide, and he was right. And there can be no question as to the identity of the perpetrators of this global genocide. The lords of capital that formulate the foreign and domestic policy of the United States. That policy calls for 20 million acres of corn from states like Iowa to be converted from food to fuel. As should have been expected, such a massive diversion almost immediately pushed up the price of all other basic foodstuffs, a global disaster made quick and easy by the fact that over the past several decades, planetary food production has been taken over by agribusiness, the speculative human parasites that control how food is bought and sold, and to whom, and for what purpose. These lords of capital are killers on a mass scale. Hot money has totally distorted the marketplace for life-sustaining goods, causing millions of the desperately poor in scores of countries to take to the streets. In less than a year, writes the Guardian newspaper in Britain, the price of wheat has risen 130%, soy by 87%, and rice by 74%. These are nothing less than crimes against humanity and cannot help but destroy the lives of millions who are already at the very edge of the precipice. The so-called market, which is actually a club of super-rich men who distort and destroy everything of value to humanity that they touch, will be the death of us all, and much quicker than through the effects of global warming, which is also greatly accelerated by the ghoulish, greedy rush to grow food for cars rather than people. In such a murderous environment, manipulated purely for the profits of the lords of capital, neither trees nor peasants stand a chance. The United Nations says it needs about $500 million for the most critical cases of starvation, but no amount of emergency aid is sufficient to make up for the wild price rises that have already occurred, and which will put trillions in the pockets of the lords of capital. Agribusiness wiped out small farmers in the U.S. and impoverished and pushed off the land untold millions of peasants worldwide. Now, the lords of capital have imposed a triage of death by starvation on the planet. The people who live on $2 or less per day will have to die. And then, as prices rise, the $3 people will follow. The men who profit from such mass murder use terms like structural adjustment and economic fundamentals to attach a veneer of rationality to a chaotic system they have created on the fly for the sole purpose of mega theft. In the end, the lords of capital have mastered only one art, the production of overlapping calamities, each more lethal than the last. Soon, if not already, the Haitian poor will have no cooking oil to mix with clay for their diet of dirt pies. The lords of capital will have turned them into dirt for another Haitian's consumption and demise. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The New World Resource Center presents We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism. It's a series of presentations highlighting the struggles and successes of Chicago area activists and organizers looking to connect the political to the everyday. The series is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at 1300 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. For more information, visit myspace.com/NWRC for the New World Resource Center.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with John K. Wilson, author of the book Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. The following interview was recorded on Friday, April 18th, 2008. We are joined on the phone with John K. Wilson. John K. Wilson is a Chicago-based author and scholar, the author of a number of books, including most recently Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom, and Its Enemies, and the book that's going to be the focus of the interview today, Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, published by Paradigm Publishers. John K. Wilson is joining us on the phone from Chicago. John K. Wilson, welcome to the show.
Glad to be talking to you.
Well, let me ask a question. I can't count the number of times I've actually seen a Barack Obama book, not the least of which are the two books for which Barack Obama himself is known. Let me begin by asking, why did you write this book, and how is this book different from other books, either by Barack Obama himself or about Barack Obama?
Well, I wrote this book, and one of the reasons why it's different is that as far as I know, it's the only one really written from a progressive perspective. And one of the things that inspired me to write it was seeing the attacks on Obama last year, many from the left, and I wanted to try and describe for progressives, for the general public as well, why I thought Obama was so important to the progressive movement and why he is a pragmatic progressive and why it's so important for progressives to understand his movement. Trying to do in writing the book. Where it differs from a lot of the other books is that it's not a biography. It doesn't try and talk about his personal background, because of course his own books have done a much better job than I think anybody else can do about that. So it's much more of a political analysis of looking at these kind of political issues about his legislative record, about his ideas about religion and politics and race, as well as this, what I call Generation Obama, this kind of youth movement that he's trying to create.
And if you could just briefly summarize, what is the analysis that you forward in the book? What's your assessment of Barack Obama?
Well, I think what Obama represents, beyond sort of the sloganeering about change, is a real shift in progressive politics, that he really is, in my view, the most progressive candidate that we've seen run for political office for the Democrats. And a lot of people don't really understand that because of the way he's also very pragmatic, that he's someone who can work with the right, work with conservatives and independents to try and get progressive legislation passed. So he's not a kind of Paul Wellstone figure, as I think some people thought he might when he entered the Senate. He is instead a really new kind of political figure out there who really has a chance to change the political landscape in lots of ways.
There's a number of people who might critique that response, justifiably so perhaps, who might respond. In fact, you actually have a chapter in the book that's entitled Why Leftists Hate a Liberal, The Far Left Attacks on Obama. I can see the kind of two-edged sword about this particular issue regarding pragmatic progressivism, where on the one hand that something like that within mainstream political discourse, I think in a lot of people would probably agree, is badly needed and is probably a very helpful corrective regarding this veering toward the center or veering toward the right that you've seen in recent years and recent decades. But on the other hand, you will find, as you outline in detail in your chapter, that there are a number of people aligned with the political left who might consider Barack Obama to be a sellout. What's your take on that, and what's the analysis you give in that regard?
Well, I mean, of course, from a certain kind of perspective, he is a sellout. No one, you know, can really be a part of the far, you know, I could have a far left agenda and get elected president. There are pragmatic considerations that that drive Obama and drive the sort of things he's standing for. But at the same time, I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing. I think what Obama brings is not just a new kind of politics, but in some ways a new way of getting to progressive politics. And that in some ways is more important than all of this. I mean, it's all lovely and all that to say, well, let's pick the candidate who has the best policy papers. But really it's a question of who can generate the kind of political will to change the kind of political calculus out there. Who can get 60 votes in the Senate to get actual legislation passed? And I think in some ways it's kind of naive to imagine that, well, all we have to do is stand strong for progressive values and that's going to win over the electorate. In pragmatic terms, you need a politician, progressives need a politician like Barack Obama in order to get the kind of legislation they want passed.
What has been the response of the left and of progressives to this assessment and to the book overall?
I'm not sure there is much of a response. I mean, it really hasn't been reviewed in any of the kind of progressive magazines and all that. So I don't think that there's necessarily been a great deal of interest in Obama among those magazines. And you see some people, kind of the Alexander Coburns, who are very critical of Obama. But in general, I think they've sort of treated him with a kind of suspicion, and there's a lot of distrust out there of people who are enthusiastic Obama supporters. And I think you're only seeing you're only really recently seeing some progressives coming around to defending Obama and seeing him for the kind of potential that he has.
If I can ask a personal question, in the front cover of your book, it's listed that you were a former student of Barack Obama at the University of Chicago. When were you a student? What class did you take, and what was your assessment of him as a teacher? And also, in what ways did that color your experience writing the book?
Well, I was a student of his in the mid-1990s, before he ran for the state Senate, shortly before that. And I took a class on racism and the law that he taught at the University of Chicago Law School. And, you know, that at the time, I thought of him as a very smart, rational kind of person. Obviously, the person I thought would never be able to make it in politics. And I think he's someone who's actually really evolved in lots of ways over since that time and become a much more effective politician since. As well as the fact, you know, he was obviously in a very different role, and a teaching role is very different from being in a kind of political role that he is now. But I think where that takes my position, I think obviously, you know, people tend to have certain biases towards people they know, and that creates certain kinds of biases that people have to watch out for. But it also creates a possibility for kind of understanding. I think a lot of people, a lot of the suspicion of Barack Obama comes from people who don't know what he is, who, when he talks about this kind of working with conservatives to getting legislation passed, that they treat that with a kind of suspicion. And because I know him, I don't really start off with that kind of suspicion. And I think that sort of enables me to get beyond that kind of barrier and see Obama and his movement for what it has the potential to be.
What can you elaborate on that potential? What do you foresee as far as the future goes for Barack Obama and the campaign that he's riding currently, perhaps to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, one of the things is, for example, that I talk about in the book is about the fact that Obama is a community organizer. He has that kind of tradition, and he's shown it very effectively in this campaign so far against Hillary Clinton, where he developed a kind of 50-state strategy, and it's really been extraordinarily effective against her kind of conventional types of politics. And I think that's one of the things that Obama brings that's very, very different to the table. Another thing about Obama that I think is important is this youth movement that he's creating. It really does have this potential for changing the political landscape, of really building a progressive majority for the long term. And what he's able to do is to really energize youth, to particularly college students, to support him, to do more than just support him, to get involved in this kind of political system. And I think one of the ways, for example, that he's really changing things is, and this is something of a controversial issue, is the way his campaign has been funded. He's really taken what Howard Dean started to do and finally brought it to fruition of having a campaign that's really financed by, you know, 1.3 million small donors. And that fundamentally changes the kind of corrupt system of politics that we have, because he doesn't really owe the donors he's been getting anything. He doesn't owe them because he has so many of them, and he has the ability to, in effect, be an independent candidate.
There's also been some question regarding what might be a foreign policy perspective, especially vis-a-vis the continuing war in Iraq. What's your assessment of Barack Obama regarding the, first off, foreign policy generally, and secondly, regarding the war in Iraq? Will he try to keep to his promises? Do you figure additional maneuvering there? What's your take?
Well, again, I think, he's been very tactical and pragmatic in terms of what he's been doing in terms of not cutting off funding early on and that sort of thing, that he was trying to, I think, in some ways get a coalition of people who are willing to support ending the war, and that coalition simply didn't exist. And he's not the kind of person who engages in kind of symbolic politics, who just takes a stand because it's regardless of whether it's going to have a pragmatic effect. I think what's important for Obama, in terms of the war in Iraq, is not so much where he stands now, because it's not that different from Hillary Clinton, per se, but where he stood back in 1992 and opposing the war from the beginning. And that's going to be the issue. It's not so much ending the war in Iraq. I think it's pretty clear that he's going to take the action to slowly end that war. I think the key issue is avoiding future wars, and I think that's where his opposition to the war in Iraq from the beginning is so important.
Another issue that has certainly come up, and certainly with great vigor, is that of the issue of Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who has certainly been the subject of great criticism on that. You talk about that very briefly in the book. Could you just explain a little bit of what your take regarding Jeremiah Wright and the entire larger issue of religion and race in this campaign means?
I think the issue about Jeremiah Wright and how it's been so badly overblown and sort of manipulated by the right-wing press, what Wright represents, I think, is for Obama, is in some sense his open-mindedness. Again, this is a person who's willing to listen to different points of view, and in some ways this comes back to haunt him, because these critics all seem to think that, well, if you go to a church, you must agree with everything a preacher there says. And that's something that I think is fundamentally alien to the way Obama thinks. He would never go out and assume that just because you associate with someone or you associate with some church, that therefore you agree with them. And I think that's something that's fundamentally important to understanding him, but unfortunately it's something that doesn't work well in the kind of soundbite politics where you have this kind of guilt by association going on. And that's something that Obama's faced with Jeremiah Wright and now with Bill Ayers and all of these others. And I think it's something that Obama has very successfully turned around to say, look, this is not the important issue. The important issue is about changing these policies in America that are failing people.
On April 16, 2008, I believe that's the date, ABC had aired a two-hour televised debate involving Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania in the run-up to the Pennsylvania primary. The debate itself has been, at least among the
Democratic Party and among left political people generally been widely denounced as basically all fluff and precious little substance. What was your take on the debate?
Well, I think it was a lot of that fluff. And it's not just that it's fluff. I mean, you sort of come to expect a certain amount of that from these debates. But there's a kind of newfangled McCarthyism going on where Barack Obama gets interrogated about wearing a flag pin and about having distant ties to Bill Ayers, who did something bad 40 years ago. And all of these kinds of things that are fundamentally contrary to what the real issues of the campaign are all about. And so that's something that I think Obama has had to really try and focus on. And in some ways, I think he's trying to take advantage of the disgust that Americans have with the way politics is done today. The disgust not only with the politicians who are part of this kind of corporate lobbying control, but also the disgust with the media and the way that it covers campaigns and the way that it participates in these kind of swift voting efforts. And we'll see if Obama is able to turn this around and to his advantage. It may be really a dramatic turn in the way this campaign and future campaigns are covered. If people can realize that these kind of attacks don't work, that they actually create public support for candidates, it would really do a lot to really change the atmosphere that's existed ever since the swift voting of John Kerry.
And the last question, what do you foresee in 2008 regarding Barack Obama? Do you think he's going to win the Democratic primary? And do you think he's going to, if so, do you think he can win the presidency or will win the presidency?
Well, he's absolutely certain to win the Democratic primary. If the only way it wouldn't happen is if Hillary Clinton convinces the superdelegates to steal the election away from him and destroy their own party. There's no evidence of that will possibly ever happen. But the question is, can he defeat John McCain? And, you know, that John McCain is kind of a perfect candidate for the Republicans, fairly moderate, well-liked by the media, well-liked by people. But I think ultimately Barack Obama simply is a supremely effective candidate. And I think he will win in November, and I think he will be the next president.
We've been speaking with John K. Wilson, a Chicago-based author and scholar, the author of a number of books, including most recently Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom, and Its Enemies. And what we've been talking about in this interview, Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest, published by Paradigm Publishers. John K. Wilson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, and listeners can go to my website, obamapolitics.com, to read my blog about the campaign and find a way to get a copy of the book.
That was an interview with John K. Wilson, author of the book Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. John K. Wilson will be speaking on a panel about academic freedom in the Crown Center Auditorium on the Lakeshore campus of Loyola University. The speech and event will take place on Thursday, April 24th, starting at 4 p.m. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.